compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I love starting the show off with good news. It smells like victory. This out of South Dakota. Ready for this? We talked yesterday about the gross unfairness, the gross inequity that is rampant across this land of ours in terms of women's sports and how men are donning female outfits and changing their hair color and hair length, etc., and are competing, if you want to call that competing, in women's sports, and they're dominating the field. I saw something on social media yesterday that predicted that in due time, if this madness continues, that men who call themselves trans will dominate all of women's sports. So just imagine if the women's soccer team for the Olympics, or the women's soccer team, you know, or some other women's team, is fielded entirely by men who identify as women. Would you consider that to be women's sports? I don't think any right-minded person would. And even the screamers on the left, you know, in spite of their slogans, I think deep down inside they would recognize there's something wrong with this. Well, some good news out of South Dakota this morning. Governor Kristi Noem, this is actually, it occurred yesterday, but it's being reported this morning. She released the text of a draft legislation to defend fairness in girls' sports at both the K-12 and collegiate level. This legislation will codify Governor Noem's executive orders and extend further protections to women and girls. Now, I realize most of you listening probably do not live in South Dakota, but hopefully this kind of forward-thinking, progressive, in the best sense of the word, attitude will spread. So this was the statement. This is the draft of the legislation that I certainly hope is going to be enacted into law. She says, this is about fairness. Every young woman deserves an equal playing field where she can achieve success. Cyrus, we don't have audio on Governor Noem saying this, do we? I just want to make sure I don't repeat something.
No, okay. I wish I would have.
Okay. You wish you would have what? You sort of trailed off there.
Oh, grab some audio.
Okay. I like it. Yeah. Anyway. So, this is about fairness. Every young woman deserves an equal playing field where she can achieve success. But common sense tells us that males have an unfair physical advantage over females in athletic competition. It is for those reasons that only girls should be competing in girls' sports. What's amazing about this, if you ask me, is that's an entirely reasonable, science-based, evidence-based statement that nowadays, because we're living in clown world run by children, nowadays, that statement, it is for those reasons that only girls should be competing in girls' sports, that would be outrageously provocative. This will be met with howls of fury and wailing and gnashing of teeth from people who think that Kristi Noem is a hater and a bigot because she's saying the honest truth that everybody knows deep down inside. But isn't it amazing we've gotten to the point in our society where that kind of a common sense statement will be greeted with howls of rage because it's so controversial in the minds of so many people. So back to Governor Kristi Noem. She says, women have fought long and hard for equal athletic opportunities and South Dakota will defend them. But we have to do it in a smart way. Only female athletes based on their biological sex shall participate in any team, sport, or athletic event designated as being for females, women, or girls. The legislation says biological sex as the sex listed on the student's official birth certificate issued at or near the time of the athlete's birth. This legislation does not have the problematic provisions that were included in last year's House Bill 1217, continued Governor Noem. And by the way, I'm reading from a news item that was issued by news.sd.gov. So it's directly from her office. She says, those flawed provisions would have led to litigation for our state as well as for the families of young South Dakota athletes, male and female alike. The article points out that Governor Noem previously protected fairness in girls' sports earlier this year when she signed two executive orders to defend it, both at the K-12 and collegiate levels. Now she's asking the legislature to put it into law. Following widespread misconceptions about Governor Noem's position on the issue, she published an op-ed in National Review to correct the record. And you can read not only the legislation itself, you just got a summary of it, but you can also read her National Review article if you care to do so, in which she explains her position. I think it's amply justified. I completely support this 100%. And I'm happy for the parents and the girls and women in South Dakota who will benefit from this common sense action. I hope it gets passed into law. Also, yes, Ars?
It's just bizarre that it needs to be passed into a law in the first place.
I know.
It's kind of like, don't park your, no elephant parking. Well, yeah. Yeah, I know I can't park my elephant here on the side of the street. And, there shouldn't be a law. It's just not, it's so asinine.
Well, yeah, the fact that they have to make this a law means that things have gotten so bad, things have deteriorated so far that not only, you're right about that, not only is it bizarre that this has to even be a law that says, in essence, men are not women and women are not men, something we've always known from the dawn of history until lately. But also, what is equally amazing about that is the strong reaction that this is provoking among those who are so dedicated to this nonsense. They've got their minds so wrapped around this nonsense that they can't get free of it. Or maybe I said it backwards. This nonsense has got itself so wrapped around their minds, like a straitjacket. They can't seem to get out of it. So for them, this statement is hugely antagonistic, and it just inflames their outrage that somebody would dare to stand up and speak the truth. But there we are. So, Cyrus, I know you're anxious for some COVID news. You always perk up when I turn to that topic. So I don't know. Is this good news? It's kind of a good news, bad news, but I think it's good news in general. Some hospitals are dropping their COVID-19 vaccine mandate to ease labor shortages. Now, this is from the Wall Street Journal. After a judge halted a Biden administration mandate for healthcare workers to get vaccinated, employers, including HCA and Tenet, have removed that requirement. Some of the largest U.S. hospital systems have dropped COVID-19 vaccine mandates. It's not a vaccine, my friend. I can hear him saying that to me agitatedly. I'm sorry. I'm just going to read it the way they wrote it. After they dropped COVID-19 vaccine mandates for staff, after a federal judge temporarily halted a Biden administration mandate that healthcare workers get the shots, hospital operators, including HCA Healthcare, Inc. and Tenet Healthcare Corp., as well as nonprofits Advent Health and the Cleveland Clinic, are dropping the mandates. Labor costs in the industry have soared, and hospitals have struggled to retain enough nurses, technicians, and even janitors to handle the higher hospitalizations in recent months as the Delta variant raged. Vaccine mandates have been a factor constraining the supply of healthcare workers, according to hospital executives, public health authorities, and nursing groups. Many hospitals already struggle to find workers, including nurses. This would be a great time to get your nursing degree. Don't get any ideas, Cyrus. I need you right where you are. But for anyone who's free, this would be a great time to become a nurse. There's jobs galore. The shortages, the Wall Street Journal says, were compounded by burnout among many medical workers and the lure of high pay rates offered to nurses who travel to hotspots or on short-term contracts. More recently, thousands of nurses have left the industry or lost their jobs rather than get vaccinated. As of September, 30% of workers at more than 2,000 hospitals across the country surveyed by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were unvaccinated. Let me reread that stat. Nurse Simcoe, stat. I know they use the word stat to mean hurry up, do it now. As of September, 30% of the workers at more than 2,000 hospitals across the country, as surveyed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, were unvaccinated. Wade Simons, an employee benefits lawyer, he says it's been a mass exodus and a lot of people in the healthcare industry are willing to go and shop around.
What was that percentage again?
30.
Wow.
Yeah, 30%. Nearly a third. If you get certain healthcare facilities that don't require it, those could be a magnet for the people who don't want the vaccine. It's not a vaccine, my friend says. I'm going to let my friend go out of the room right now. It's like A Beautiful Mind. It gets to the point where now, remember that movie, A Beautiful Mind, Russell Crowe?
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to spoil the movie for anybody who hasn't seen it yet. Watch the movie. It's a surprise
20-year-old spoilers. Watch out.
Yeah, I know. Well, there are some people somewhere who may not have seen the movie. But once you see the movie and you re-listen to this part of the show, you'll know what I'm referring to. I'm going to let him out of the room so he won't bother me anymore. Because whenever I see the word vaccine, I hear his voice saying that to me. All right, he's out. A federal judge in Louisiana ruled in November that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services didn't have the authority to mandate vaccines for healthcare workers, blocking a Biden administration rule that affected some 10 million workers. The mandate had required all workers at facilities that participate in Medicare and Medicaid to get second shots by January 4th. The American Hospital Association estimates that 42% of U.S. hospitals, some 2,640 facilities, do have COVID-19 mandates in place. Alan Levine, isn't he the lead singer for Maroon 5 or whatever they're called? Different guy.
Yeah, pretend like you don't know.
What is the title of that band again? I should know this. It's Maroon something. Maroon 5?
Maroon, that is the name of a band. I have no idea.
That's what I'm thinking of. That's what I like their music. So he says, I don't think the mandates were helpful. He's the chief executive officer of Ballad Health. They have 21 hospitals in Tennessee and Virginia. He says, I don't think the mandates were helpful, and I think the court in Louisiana did everyone a service. His company has about 14,000 employees, some 2,000 of whom are not vaccinated or didn't request an exemption to the requirement. He said that many people having to be terminated would have been devastating to our system. I'm thinking right now about the U.S. military and how the U.S. military seems intent upon purging from its ranks service members who have not been vaccinated. And just as things are heating up with China and Russia right now, it seems like a very short-sighted thing to be doing. But in any case, I have some additional information on this topic. Then we'll go to some phone calls. My number is 888-914-9149. This is from The Lancet. And we hear it mentioned from time to time. I looked it up on the interwebs, and it's described as, The Lancet is a weekly peer-reviewed general medical journal. It is among the world's oldest and best-known general medical journals, founded in 1823 by an English surgeon, and he named it after the surgical tool instrument called a lancet, or we would call it a scalpel here. So it is a prestigious, well-regarded, highly read, peer-reviewed medical journal, one of the top in the world, and they just ran an article. It's an opinion piece by a physician by the name of Günter Kampf, K-A-M-P-H. And Cyrus will get a link to this so you can read it for yourself. Now, this just appeared in The Lancet. It's still on their website. I went there and I looked it up and printed it out, and I'm going to read it to you. It's not very long. So Dr. Kampf says, in the U.S. and Germany, high-level officials have used the term pandemic of the unvaccinated, suggesting that people who have been vaccinated are not relevant in the epidemiology of COVID-19. Officials' use of the phrase might have encouraged one scientist to claim that, quote, the unvaccinated threaten the vaccinated for COVID-19. And he responds by saying, this view is far too simple. There is increasing evidence that vaccinated individuals continue to have a relevant role in transmission. In Massachusetts, a total of 469 cases were detected during various events in July of 2021. And 74% of these cases were in people who were fully or partly vaccinated. Only 74% of them. So let me just recap that. So of the new COVID-19 cases, this is just in Massachusetts, of course, in the month of July, 74% of the cases were from people who were fully or partly vaccinated, not from people who were unvaccinated. Cycle threshold values were similarly low between people who were fully vaccinated and people who were unvaccinated, not fully vaccinated, or whose vaccination status was unknown, indicating a high viral load even among people who were fully vaccinated. In the USA, a total of 10,262 COVID-19 cases reported in vaccinated people by April 30th of 2021, of whom 2,725, that's 26.6%, were asymptomatic. Nearly 10% were hospitalized. 1.6% died. So what is that? It's 98.4% survival rate in that group. And he gives some other statistics. He brings Germany into it. He says people who are vaccinated have a lower risk of severe disease, but are still a relevant part of the pandemic. It is therefore, this is his conclusion, it is therefore wrong and dangerous to speak of a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Historically, both the USA and Germany have engendered negative experiences by stigmatizing parts of the population for their skin color or religion. Let me just park on that statement for a minute. I'm just going to read it. Cyrus, you react to it, okay? This is like a masterpiece of understatement. He says, historically, both the USA and Germany have engendered negative experiences by stigmatizing part of the population for their skin color or religion. That is like a masterpiece of understatement.
That's a pretty big understatement.
Could you have said it any more subtly?
No.
I couldn't either. I mean, that is just...
Yeah, sometimes we have, issues with some other people that are different than us.
Right. I think it would be fair to say that the U.S. has engendered negative experiences by stigmatizing part of the population for its skin color. And I think it's very fair to say that Germany has engendered negative experiences by stigmatizing part of its population because of their religion. But I'll proceed. This is his final statement. So he says it's wrong and dangerous to portray or mischaracterize the pandemic as if it's all the fault of the unvaccinated. And his last point is, I call on high-level officials and scientists to stop the inappropriate stigmatization of unvaccinated people who include our patients, colleagues, and other fellow citizens, and to put an extra effort into bringing society together. That's in The Lancet. And he's got the numbers to back it up. And I think he's right on target. I see a lot of that among leftists, especially Catholics, leftist Catholics on Twitter, who are just foaming at the mouth and ranting on a near daily basis, it seems. I try to avoid these people, but I can't seem to help but stumble over them from time to time. And they're just constantly complaining and maligning people who are not vaccinated as if they were the problem and those who have been vaccinated are not.
So if it's not them, it must be the people not wearing masks.
Well, them too. Yeah, them too. But it's patently false, as this physician points out, and it's worthy of note. That's all. I just want to bring it to people's attention. Because why? Because follow the science, right? That's what the science says. And I'm all about science. You know me, science.
I need to be mad at somebody, Patrick. Who am I supposed to be mad at?
Well, I mean, if you're one of those kind of people, you'll still be... You won't care about the science. You won't
find something.
You'll just dismiss it. You're still going to be angry at the unvaccinated people.
Yep.
You're still going to rage and fulminate against the unvaccinated people and how they're killing people. Science be damned. Statistics and medical evidence be damed. They don't care. They've picked their target.
I'm still hearing the narrative that if you're vaccinated, you can't get COVID. Oh, I'm vaccinated. I'm good.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost as if it's the silver bullet. And I don't know what it is that people don't seem to hear that. But actually, to be fair, some people do hear that and they go in the other direction, where they wear masks to bed at night. They wear masks in the shower. They wear masks wherever they go. Doesn't matter where they go. They wear 3 masks, 4 masks. They're one step away of getting in the bubble boy suit because they're living in this belief that, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I put the bubble boy suit in the closet and I'm never getting it out again.
Never say never, Cyrus.
Let's take a break.
All right. Let's take a break. I'll be right back. We'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I'll be home for Christmas.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I have no clue how to do an Elvis impersonation. You know who could do a great Elvis impersonation? Jim Burnham, my former, I guess he's still kind of my fill-in host when I'm gone. He really does a great Elvis. We should get him to do that sometime.
I'd like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention, too, I've been listening to, faithfully, the Merry Beggars production of A Christmas Carol, I got to tell you, I mean, I knew it was going to be good. I didn't know it was going to be this good. I am blown away by just how wonderful. I don't know a better word for it. It's wonderfully produced. The music, the cast, the sounds. I mean, every creaking door or, you know, clip-clopping horses' hooves or whatever it may be. I mean, it feels like you're there in snowy London of, what is it, 1843, I think, when Charles Dickens published this book. It's really, really good. No one's asking me to say this. I'm just saying it because it really is good. And I just want to thank Peter and everybody who's involved in this production. It's superlative. And quite frankly, I've never heard anything like it, certainly not on Catholic radio. And I just encourage everybody listening, if you haven't signed up to get the daily installments, their audio installments, to your email box, you can do it by going to relevantradio.com. And as I say, this is not a commercial. No one asked me to say this. I just think it's that good. And you would really be missing out if you didn't hear this and enjoy this, you know, the audio spectacle of A Christmas Carol. Really good. The kids are going to love it. Even, you know, young fogies like me, we love it too. You love it, Cyrus, don't you?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. The cast is perfect, but I'm really blown away by the it's not Foley, I guess, but it's the use of the sound effects. Just perfect. Well done.
You know, I remember asking Peter Atkinson, the producer, whether or not there would be Foley artists there in the studio, and I don't remember now whether he said yes or no. Is it no? I mean, they don't have Foley people.
I doubt it's not like a live. It's not like old time radio with Orson Welles where it was live, and they're you know,
don't give anything
doors
away. No. Don't give anything away. Let it be the theater of the mind.
It is. It really is. I mean, you have it on for 1 minute and you're lost in the story. Yeah.
What I really liked about it too is that the way the story unfolds is that, so like when the kid is on his way to the theater where the, you know, the reading of A Christmas Carol is going to be held, and there's some old fellow who wants, you know, can you tell me where the theater is? And then they pull you as the listener into the audience. It's like, hey, you, the listener, come with us. So you really feel, I felt, drawn in almost as if I were one of the characters, although I didn't have a speaking part. But I love it. I think it's really good. Have your kids heard it yet, Cyrus?
No, my plan was to play it while we were driving around, and I haven't been playing Taxi as much for the kids the last couple weeks. So it's right. I have it on my phone. It's ready to go.
You've primed the pump.
That's right. I'm ready.
I'm sure they're going to love it. Well, congratulations, you know, Peter Atkinson and everybody else involved with The Christmas Carol. It's brilliant. It's superb. It's wonderful. And I really do hope all of you listening will take a moment to get hooked into it as well. Let's go to the phones, 888-914-9149. We'll start off in Chicago talking to Ann. Hi, Ann.
Hi, yes, good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question about the birth of Jesus. If you watch The Chosen and the latest Christmas version of The Chosen, it's quite physical. You feel like you're in, you know, a delivery room, and there's pain, mm-hmm. and, it, you know, it's very well produced and such. But a friend of mine last night was saying that, you know, Jesus wasn't born that way. He just appeared, and there was no virginal birth for Jesus. Mary was a virgin before, during, and after, and she said that's straight dogma, and I don't know, and so I called you so I could learn.
Yes, this is, let me explain it as best I can. This is indeed a dogma, and the dogma is known as Mary's perpetual virginity. And in the dogmatic formulations of this teaching, it says that Mary was a virgin and remained a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus. And that word during is a statement of her perpetual virginity, indicating, number one, that she did not lose her virginity at any point along the way. And that must be understood in two ways. One way would be the natural process by which children are conceived. That did not occur in the case of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So in that sense of the word virginity, she never lost her virginity. But also, the church says that this extends to the physical integrity of her body. And that's where this question arises. Well, if that's true, if the physical integrity of her body was not changed, then what exactly happened? How can a baby be born without the physical integrity of the body being changed? So this is where the church just passes over this in a discreet silence. There is no revelation from God that tells us anything about that specific aspect of it. We know that it's true, but it's true in the same kind of way as the conception of Jesus took place miraculously. So in Luke chapter 1, the angel Gabriel tells the Blessed Virgin Mary that the Holy Spirit would overshadow her. Now, that term, to overshadow, you see that in Exodus chapter 35, 34, where you see that the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament was overshadowed, and we're told it was filled with the glory of God. So that language in Exodus is very reminiscent of how Mary herself was overshadowed by the Holy Spirit. So how is it, we can ask, that even though there was no human father involved at any point along the way, how is it that Our Lady conceived a normal, healthy, one-cell little boy named Jesus? How is it that that could happen? That part of it has not been revealed to us, just as how it is that Mary remained a virgin before, during, and after at all points along the way, that too has not been revealed to us. So my thinking, Anne, is that if we can accept the fact that Mary conceived in her womb a child without the help of a human father, this is a miraculous conception, and we don't know how it happened because God has not revealed to us, but it's sufficient for us to know that it did happen. I take the same approach to this issue. I don't need to know how it happened. And God in his wisdom did not deign to reveal to us how it happened. So I'm content to just say, well, I know it did happen, therefore I leave it at that. Now, there are those who have speculated about how might this have happened. Some say, and I'm referring, for example, to church fathers who commented on it, some say that it was what we would consider a normal birth in every sense of the word, and yet, in spite of the normal way in which children come out of the womb of their mothers, God nonetheless maintained the intactness of her bodily integrity. God can do that if he wants to do that, and that's entirely possible. Another view that some have proffered would be that it would be similar to a ray of light passing through a pane of glass, and how it does go through the pane of glass, but it doesn't break the glass as it passes through. So that was another way of wondering if maybe that's how, in a miraculous sort of way, perhaps the Lord was born in the normal manner, but in a way that didn't injure her integrity. So that's another possibility. We just don't know. And the church doesn't say that we have to hold one view or the other. What we are obliged to hold is the view, or the teaching rather, that Mary was perpetually a virgin before, during, and after the birth of Jesus. Then one last thing. It is true also that Mary, because she's immaculately conceived and never suffered from the taint of original sin, nor did she ever commit any actual sins, she was exempt from the penalty of pain in childbirth that the Lord had pronounced as a malediction upon Eve and all women after her, with the exception of Mary. Because Mary was sinless, there was no penalty for her, and pain in childbirth is one of those penalties. So some theologians have speculated that just as, in a way similar to how baptism was not necessary for Jesus, even though he was baptized, he didn't need to be baptized because he was sinless. And by being baptized, he established the sacrament of baptism. And also, Jesus being free from all sin, he was not subject to the maledictions, the curses that God pronounced, including death as one of them. And yet he did die. He did suffer and die, even though he was exempt from those penalties. So some theologians have speculated, and I think this is not unreasonable, that in a similar way, Our Lady experienced the pain of childbirth, perhaps, again, we don't know, but she may have experienced the pain of childbirth as a way to be in union with her son, knowing in some sense that he would suffer for our salvation, and uniting herself to his sufferings, that she was willing to accept this as something that was not proper to her, given her sinlessness, but she was willing to accept it as suffering. Now, the one little clue to this is that in Revelation chapter 12, in verse 1 and 2, you see where St. John says, then a great sign appeared in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun, standing on the moon with a crown of 12 stars around her head. She was wailing aloud in pain as she labored to give birth. And the male child who is born to this woman is Jesus. So from a literal standpoint, not only is the male son Jesus, but the mother is Mary. Now, some will be quick to say, no, that is referring to Israel. And that is indeed one of the possible meanings. You know, the scripture has typically four different meanings, none of which are mutually exclusive. So in a literal sense, that certainly refers to Mary, but does the wailing aloud in pain as she labored to give birth, does that refer to Mary specifically, or is that something that is alluding to Israel as it labored to the point where the Messiah finally came forth? That's something I'd have to leave to the scripture scholars and the theologians, but that does give a little bit of a clue as to how it might be that Mary, although she was not subject to the penalty of original sin, nonetheless, she may have accepted it as part of uniting herself to Jesus. Now, that's a long answer, Anne. Forgive me for the amount of information, but I think it's such an important topic that we have to at least give some of these bigger picture issues so that people understand it. Does that help a little bit?
Yes, yes, it does. The pain question was my follow-up question. So my only question remaining then is, what do we think of the Chosen? Should we discourage our children from watching that Christmas special? Because it offers a fairly Protestant view of how Jesus came into the world with pain, and seems contrary to the dogma that you just explained.
Yeah, I think that I would take this approach. Now, I've seen one episode of The Chosen. Everybody I know seems to be in love with it. And okay, great. I mean, they love it. They find it very edifying. I saw one episode. I wasn't particularly wowed by it, but I mean, it was good as far as it went. But I have nothing against it. I'm not against The Chosen at all. But I would take the St. Paul approach, you know, test everything and hold fast to that which is good. So if you're watching it with your children, it is a good teaching moment. You could say, you know, here's an example of where they're using artistic license to depict something. They don't really know exactly what happened. So they're portraying it in this way. But don't let this Hollywood portrayal change your understanding of what divine revelation says about Mary and her birth. I think it would be safe enough for the kids to watch. I mean, those who are age appropriate. And with your guidance, you can help them to see that this is just the way they think it might have happened. But, you know, we know that Mary did not have to suffer the pains of childbirth because she was exempt from original sin. So it could be a teachable moment.
Okay. I appreciate that. They do take artistic license on many different fronts. How the teaching on the Mount occurred, and the paper flyers, which obviously didn't happen, but the backstory they imagine for Nicodemus, mm-hmm. I think is highly credible. It's fascinating show.
Yeah, everybody I've talked to loves it. I just haven't seen enough of it to know myself.
Yeah, it's not all biblical, but it makes you think. It makes you think.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I had a great reaction to Jesus of Nazareth, which came out as a multi-part series in 1977. To me, that's still the high watermark for the Jesus movies. I don't know if you've seen that one, Anne. I've got to run. Thank you. I'll be right back. Have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Happiness is automatic.
We have a lot of fun on this program, what can I tell you? And you're invited. Give me a call, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Mike in Staten Island, New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Patrick. Patrick, I was in Manhattan the other day at a parish not my own, and in the back of the church I saw a pamphlet, and it said Divine Mercy After Suicide, and it was written by a priest named Chris Solar, who actually wrote a book under the same title, who had actually lost his grandmother to a suicide. And to just surmise this, basically what he's saying, his contention is in the book that since God is outside of time, that so are our prayers. In other words, he gave an example like if someone had committed suicide, say, in 1991, our prayers, say, if you say the Divine Mercy Chaplet for that person in 2021, God can apply those prayers redemptively back in time. He quotes like Padre Pio and some modern day theologians like Jimmy Akin and Peter Kreeft who all to substantiate this position. It kind of blew me away because if it's true, I mean, how great is that? But it doesn't seem to quite jive with the official teaching of the church. So I was wondering if you can kind of clarify that for me.
I'll do my best. Well, this is something I've been saying for years. So I concur with Padre Pio. I mean, he's way out of my league, obviously. But yes, it's true. Since God is outside of time, he's not limited by time as you and I are. So we remember the past. We're experiencing these endless processions of moments that we call now. And we anticipate the future. Well, in God's case, there is no past, future, or present, or I should say everything is present to God all at once in a way that we can't even really begin to imagine what that's like, but it's still true. So if we use some logical process here, we can say that given that God is outside of time and space, our prayers in time are not inefficacious if God chooses to apply them in a situation that, for us, happened in the past. Now, we have to make a distinction here, because this does not mean that you can change the destiny of somebody who has died and been judged and gone to hell. So let's say somebody commits suicide, which is a grievous mortal sin. Not everybody is necessarily culpable of that sin because of mental illness or substance abuse or grave fear. I mean, there are many ways in which somebody's culpability could be greatly diminished or eliminated, but it's still, objectively speaking, a grave sin, a mortal sin. So if somebody dies by his own hand and is judged and goes to hell, our prayers now, you mentioned 1991, so all those years later, our prayers now have no effect whatsoever on that person's eternal destiny. We can't change that. But at least this view is that our prayers now could be applied by God to that person before he died so that he would have, you know, the recourse to God's mercy and forgiveness before he died. And usually when this topic comes up, I mention the story that's told by St. John Vianney, the curé of Ars, and he told a family who's the father, the husband, who had committed suicide by jumping off a bridge. And St. John Vianney was given by God to know the certain destiny of that person, and that was salvation. And he told the family, he said that he is saved. He is saved. He's going to go to heaven. He's in purgatory now, but he's going to go to heaven. And God showed me that just before his body hit the water, which would have killed him, just before this happened, he converted. He repented. And he received God's gift of grace and mercy and forgiveness, and he was saved. So if we can draw upon that example from a great saint, we could say, I think with safety, we could say that it may well be that the prayers of those for his soul after the fact may have been applied by God before he died. God is certainly capable of doing that. And to argue against that would, in essence, be a way to try to limit God, which is impossible. So that much we can say. Now, again, just for the sake of emphasis, we don't believe that we can change anybody's destiny by our prayers after the fact. That much is fixed. Does that help a little bit?
It does. So you're saying basically he could use it before the fact, take our prayers now and use it before, like, say, the person committed the actual act, he could use our prayers almost like preemptively. I understand that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you. I find a lot of hope and encouragement in that realization. I hope you do too. Let's go now to Kathy in Chicago. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Patrick, I have a comment about the virgin birth.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned the before, during, and after.
Yes.
And I'm concerned about the during, when okay. The child would be coming out. I want to fast forward to the resurrection. And after the resurrection, mm-hmm. the apostles were in the upper room, scared as heck, had the door locked and commiserating with each other. And Jesus came in. And how did he get in? He didn't knock. He didn't turn the key. He passed through the door, the heavy wooden door. And if he could do that, why not through the birth channel? He could just pass through. And there wouldn't have to be any blood because he's not breaking anything or cutting, you know, destroying mm-hmm. anything. He passed through. Mm-hmm. And I like this idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that tracks with what the church fathers who comment on this, and I forget now which one it was. I don't know if it was St. Augustine or who it was. I could go back and check. But it was similar to how they use the analogy of a ray of light passing through a pane of glass, that mm-hmm. it would pass through. It would go from one side through it to the other side, but it would not harm the glass. Yeah. It would not break the glass. Now, keep in mind, just a little thing to remember, is that the incident you're referring to in Acts chapter 1 was after Jesus had his glorified body. So in his glorified body, of course, he could do amazing things. But even before he received his glorified body, so back in Matthew chapter 14, we have the incident where Jesus is walking on the water. That, too, is a miraculous capability that our bodies don't have normally, but he did. So in that case, it was not his glorified body in which he was walking on the water, but in the case of walking through the wall or the door in the upper room, that was his glorified body. So I think in a way, it's almost a distinction without a difference. So yes, your recognition of that fits nicely with the church's teaching.
Yeah, I was thinking that because he was still before his birth, he was in a different place with God. You know, like glorified. He wasn't glorified, but he was special because he hadn't actually been born yet, so that he could do that.
Well, he was no more special in the womb than he was after his birth. It wasn't as though he became less special after his birth. From the moment of his incarnation, when he was a single cell human being, he remained as perfect and any superlative we could say about Jesus could be said from the very moment of his conception. So there was nothing unique There was nothing that changed in him from before he was born till after he was born. Maybe yeah. that's the best
but
way.
But he was
I can
unique,
say it.
And that's why he could do it.
Yes, unique is the right word because nobody else is like Jesus. Jesus is a divine person who has a divine and a human nature. All the rest of us are human persons with all of our limitations. So yeah. that is certainly true.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
And I don't know who brought up you said it might have been Augustine or somebody, whoever. I don't know. I you need to sit down and think about it, and we can come to this. That's how I found it,
yeah.
by meditating upon it.
Yeah, and my view of this is simply that because of the delicate nature of this topic, and I'm sure you understand what I'm saying, that God, in his wisdom, chose not to reveal the specifics of it to us. He revealed to us that it happened. That much we know. Mary is a perpetual virgin. But how in which that took place, it's not for us to know. In heaven, I suppose maybe we'll know. But for now, I'm content to just dwell upon the fact that this was a miracle that God worked for Mary. Praise God. Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate it. How about now Jane in Minnesota? Hi, Jane.
Hello. So my daughter, who is 17, mm-hmm. has recently told me that when she turns 18, she's going to smoke a cigarette. she said, I'm just going to smoke one cigarette because I want to know what it's like. Mm-hmm. And so this leads me to the larger question of how to respond when underage teenagers say, well, when I'm 18, I'm going to do this, mm-hmm. even though I know I shouldn't, or you wouldn't approve of it, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, I mean, you can say to her what I told my kids, and not entirely successfully in my case, but I say, you know, you could do that. I mean, you have the freedom to do it, but it's dumb. I mean, it's dumb to smoke cigarettes. And with all due respect to those who smoke cigarettes, it is dumb because it's harming your body. So you could tell her that, and you could say, you know, why go through the school of hard knocks if you don't have to? Why start something that could become addictive to you if you don't have to? And then what I would do is I would sit down with her and I would watch the CDC ads on smoking. Former smokers. Just go into YouTube and type in CDC former smokers. And they have a whole bunch of videos. Typically, they're made for television, so about a minute long. And they just show people who are now talking out of the hole in their throats because they had to have a, I don't know, would that be a tracheotomy? Whatever the procedure was, they no longer can use their voice because it, you know, they got cancer. And there are a number of them. There's a whole bunch of videos that are very high-powered, very, very effective. They make you think twice. And when you see what these people are going through, and they're saying to you, don't smoke, don't start smoking, don't do what I did, don't wind up where I am right now. I think if nothing else, it's going to throw a scare into her in a good way. And, you know, then, of course, you have to stand back and let her make her own decisions. But at least you will have intervened in a way that will hopefully at an emotional level, if nothing else, get her to see this is really a dumb idea.
Right. Well, I've definitely taught her and all the other kids how unhealthy smoking is. And,
yeah.
She understands that it causes cancer. And then she's kind of argued, there have been times when she said, well, why won't the church forbid smoking? And she's pointed out to me that it's not listed as a sin. She says it's listed as an imperfection. Is that true?
Well, the church has not gotten to the point where it has condemned smoking, but the church in a broader sense condemns, according to the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, and that extends to doing anything that would be intentionally harmful to your body. That is not necessary. So, I mean, it's intentionally harmful to your body to cut your leg off, but if you have gangrene, you have to cut your leg off or it'll kill you. So it doesn't refer to things like that, but if you're doing something to your body, whether it's mutilation or ingesting poisons, smoking would be another example. The church, I think, from a moral standpoint says, yeah, if you're doing something intentionally to your body that is harmful to it, you're offending against the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, because you are slowly but surely destroying your body. So that has not been emphasized in the catechism, for example, but I think in due course, the church could get to that point where it would take up smoking as a specific example of this. As of now, though, it hasn't. But I say that it does fall under the fifth commandment in any case. Give it a try, Jane. Go to the YouTubes and look up CDC former smokers. And if your daughter watches those videos and still wants to smoke, that'll be amazing. I'll be right back.